Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you in-depth interviews with the stars and creators of the hottest shows on Broadway, off-Broadway, and beyond. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to the writer Rick Ellis and the director Jason Moore, who are the creators of The Cher Show, the new bio-musical that just opened on Broadway. Ellis knows a thing or two about behind-the-music stage shows. He wrote the book to the Tony winner Jersey Boys, as well as shows including The Addams Family and Peter and the Starcatcher. Moore, meanwhile, has directed Broadway musicals including Avenue Q and Shrek, and movies like Pitch Perfect and the Tina Fey Amy Poehler comedy Sisters. Rick and Jason are among the major players who put together this splashy new Broadway look at the life of Cher, and they're taking us behind the scenes with one real-life superstar, three onstage Chers, and a lot of feathers, sequins, and skin. Hi, Rick and Jason. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Gordon. Thanks for having us.
Hi, Gordon.
So I feel like the first question I have to ask both of you is, when did you meet Cher and what was she wearing?
Wow.
Well, while you, Jason, think, I, Rick, will answer.
That was very professional, identifying yourself.
The first time I met her was at the hotel suite where we were just the other day, and she was wearing a white do-rag on her head, and she was wearing holy jeans and a T-shirt sort of in the Jennifer Beale mode, you know, with shoulder. And that was in New York. And the first time I met her in California at her home, she was wearing yoga pants and this time all in black yoga pants, no shoes, no socks, and the same sort of sweatshirt. And then it was a really hot day, and she said, "I'm going in the pool. You want to come?" And the next thing I knew, she was wearing nothing, and she was in the pool.
Yeah. Is she still impossibly glamorous, no matter what she's wearing?
The thing that struck me, especially in New York, she was getting glammed up because she was going, I think, to the Met Gala that night.
Right. Mm. How many years ago was this?
This was at the end of May of 2015.
Okay.
When I first met her
here in New York. Yeah, okay.
And then the following October, I remember it was just before Halloween, because I arrived with a Buddha in one arm and a pumpkin in the other, because I figured one of these will be okay.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be the Buddha that was appropriate. Huh. And then we sort of played football with the pumpkin. There she was completely unadorned. You know, she was wearing no makeup. She just had her hair done. She just finished her yoga class. She was a little overheated, and I thought, wow, you know, this is a really great-looking woman.
And you were meeting with her to talk about the show and what it would be at that point?
Well, really meeting with her to talk about if there was a show, what it might be like, but mostly just to sort of get to know each other, because before any ideas about what the show might be like, it was important to know what it was about her that she felt an audience needed to know. It's such a well-documented life, and she's been famous for so long and photographed for so long. That it's possible to never have bought a Cher record or to have seen an episode of the Sonny and Cher show or to have never seen her in a film and still to know almost everything about her. Yeah. You know, she's just sort of in the soup. So my big question was, what could I tell an audience that would make it worth their time to come and see the show, especially since you're out there on the road still performing, still touring all over the place, playing Vegas? If they want to see Cher, they can go see Cher.
Right. And what did you decide from those meetings? What did you take away from those meetings that you thought, this is what this show needs to tell audiences?
I found that we bonded in they say write what you know, and I don't know, I didn't know very much about Cher other than the public knowledge, but I found quickly talking to her that we bonded in sort of some emotional experiences that were very similar. And we talked a lot about, my husband had just died, and we talked a lot about loss and how she managed to find her way back into the world of living. In fact, she said on the phone when she called me and she said, I really think you should come out and we should get to know each other. She said, I want you to rejoin the human race. And I said, oh, Cher, you're quoting Thornton Wilder, really? And she said, no, I'm quoting Hello, Dolly. And then we laughed and laughed and laughed, and I thought, okay, I can talk to this person.
And this would have been before you came on board, Jason, is
correct.
That right?
Yeah.
Okay, because you came on a couple of years later,
a year later. Less than a year later, by the summer of 16, Jason was in charge.
And then tell me about sort of the, as you went from there, Rick and Jason, once you were aboard, how did you think about what the show should look like and feel like and what it should, you know, be about?
Well, after Rick had spent the weeks with Cher and then written the draft, that's when I came aboard, and I was thrilled because it had these theatrical layers to it. You know, it's a life, incredible life lived, and incredible, you know, range of songs and styles and decades, which was kind of what I expected and hoped would be there. But Rick had created these extra theatrical layers that I thought made it really special.
Ooh, for those who haven't seen it or read
sure.
it yet, what is that?
There were two at the time. One was that there were three women who play Cher, but not just because of age difference, but because it's sort of like the notion of Cher talking to herself, the voices in her head, that your older self talks to your younger self and negotiates your memories and has different points of views on things at different periods. So the three Chers are on stage the whole time, sort of having the same experience and reliving it from their own perspectives. That was one. And then we had sort of a layer of the Cher show was a variety show being performed, and there was a backstage story as well.
Oh, That is not there right now.
Well, you know, it came out of those early days when I was spending day after day with her, and at the end of every day she would say, so what do you think? What do you want to do? What do you want to do? And in the course of our conversations, it became clear that she was much more knowledgeable about cinema than she was about theater. So on the last day, as I was gathering, you know, my things and getting ready to go to the airport, she said, so what do you want to do? And I had been thinking about the Sonny and Cher show, variety show that she had talked about a lot. Excuse me. And so I said, really, just as a way to go and say goodbye, I said, we had already talked about the use of more than one actor to play Cher.
How did that come up? In terms of, was that initially talked about as an Ages of Cher kind of thing?
It was in the very, very first conversation I had with her at the hotel, and she said, how do you think you'd want to do this? And I said, I'm not sure that I'm the right person to do this. And she said, but if you were, what would you do? And I said, well, off the top of my head, I wouldn't have one actor play Cher. You're too famous. Everybody knows who you are. I had co-written Jersey Boys with the legendary Marshall Brickman.
Yes.
And we had an easier task there because while people were familiar with the Four Seasons music, they were not familiar at all with those four guys. So any reasonable facsimile of those guys was acceptable to the audience because they didn't know better. With Cher, you can't get away with that. And, of course, there's a whole industry of Cher impersonators who are quite well known and quite out there. And so I said, what would amuse me is the ability to take a song, let's say, that we've only ever heard as a solo, and hear it as a duet or a trio. What would amuse me is that instead of relying on a narrative device, to where the actor turns out to the audience and says, and then you'll never believe what happened next. If you had more than one, they could actually play a girl group as opposed to a single person, and they could argue with each other, support each other, push back against each other, as Jason was describing. Right. And I thought, as a writer, I thought that would be fun to write those scenes and to kind of think, well, maybe they could be written as a monologue, divided amongst three voices, and then tempered by the idea of what you might know when you were 16 that you would have forgotten by the time you were 50, and vice versa. But also, I liked the musical variety that it it would give us, and to present songs that audiences have heard a million times in a way that made them feel like they were hearing it maybe for the first time, and to have the power of multiple female voices, I think is a thrilling sound in the theater, and it's not done enough. So that was very, very. So I said that, and she said, "Oh, well, that's sort of interesting." And then I talked about, you know, it's an old. I mean, Shakespeare. Not only Shakespeare did it, but you know, the very first actor to play Oedipus was in fact three actors, because Aeschylus had a funny voice, and he wanted to, describe an entire lifetime in one evening in the amphitheater. So it's just like it's an old theatrical device, and I thought the old theatrical devices are still around because they work well.
When did you find out that the Donna Summer musical happened to be doing something kind of similar?
About a year and a half later.
Yeah.
Cher, in her enthusiasm, when I got off the plane, coming home from having spent a few days with her, she had already announced on Twitter that I was doing it.
So
and
it was
that,
happening.
And that yeah. I was doing it, yeah. and that we were going to do it with three Chers. So I thought, oh, you know, I called her and said, you know, Cher, it would be better to, you only get one bite at the apple, and like until this is real. And she said, well, Cher gets as many bites as Cher wants. And I said, and she talks about herself in the third person. and that's when I knew that the three was a really good idea, right? Because, so we have the third person, the second person, and the first person in our show, and she actually does that. But going out, leaving that last day just to get out the door, I said, maybe we'll do the Terry Gilliam variety show of your life. Right. Because Terry Gilliam, I knew she would know, right, because she knows everything about movies. And she went, oh, that sounds good. And then I got in the car and I thought, what the hell does that even mean? And then I spent a few months trying to figure it out because I didn't know
say
Jason
that Terry
then.
Gilliam, if people don't know who Terry Gilliam is, he is the director of films like Brazil. And what other crazy surreal things?
Well, you know, the Von Munchausen.
Time Bandits. Favorite
yes.
of mine.
You know,
the ship comes through the closet.
Within which, and that's right. what I said, you know, like where a little boy opens his closet in his bedroom and a pirate ship comes out.
Right.
I like that kind of theater. And what's extraordinary about it on screen is that you don't usually see it, because film can be mostly a literal medium. And theater, of course, is a theatrical medium. And I love theatricality and simplicity and the power of the audience playing along, the interactivity of it, where you can say, this chair is a tree, and the audience goes, okay, it's a tree.
And so then, Jason, how do you create that world on stage? How do you think about staging it and making it magical?
Well, when we kind of really leaned into the notion of these three chairs as the sort of center theatrical device that we wanted, and that there was a variety show conceit that we had sort of left mostly behind in Chicago, but we decided to lean into that, which is that the audience feels like they already have a relationship with Cher. On the TV show, she's talked to the camera. In her concert, she talks to the audience. And so we decided that would be one of the driving principles, is that we were doing a musical first, but it could have some of the flavors of a variety show, which means you have a host, you have an opening number, you have a host, you have a comic monologue, you have a sketch. And those were the things that Rick had already done in the original draft. And so for the New York production, we really decided to lean into that idea. So, you know, we also looked at all those old variety shows, and we have a set that's mostly made of lights, which is what all the old shows had, so it can feel sort of modern and vintage at the same time. It has definitive, like, now we're hosting and telling you what you're about to see next. We have some sketches that are done in style, like a Western style. And so it has it is a musical comedy in that way, is that there's a lot of variety to it. Our biggest challenge was also the writing challenge, which is there's so much life, so many songs, so many locations, is sort of ease of how do you make that move quickly. And Rick's very good at keeping the music and drama driving.
Well, that was one of my questions, is how hard is it to find, and Rick, you've obviously done this before, how hard is it to find to match a song that already exists with an emotional moment that is, in most cases, happening at the concurrent time that the song was recorded? Is that a How hard is that? That feels like a lot of puzzle pieces to try and fit together all at once.
Well, I like puzzles. You know, I think writing a musical is, in fact, a great big puzzle, which is why the super talented geniuses that whose names we all know and revere sometimes have shows that are wonderful and sometimes have shows that aren't. There's no... God, I'm so sorry.
That's quite all right.
It might be an offer.
Yeah.
Because there's no formula, and it's not a science, it's an art, you know, you never quite know what you're doing or if it's going to be right or wrong. You're guessing a lot of the time. Hopefully they're educated guesses, and hopefully you'll guess right more than you guess wrong. There's a lot of trial and error. With Cher, the additional challenge was you don't want it to be sort of a Wikipedia kind of a show, bullet points, you know, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. You want to be able to do some deep dives. And 55 years is a long time for 2.5 hours on stage, where half hour of that time is, you know, intermission and curtain going up at 5 minutes after the hour. So, and you know that there's going to be way more than an hour of music because it's a musical, and you know, and the audience must be satisfied.
What you were talking about in terms of finding the emotional moment that matches the song is one of the things that I love that Rick did in the original draft and continues to do is we don't actually adhere to the timeline. We can take a song from the later disco era and we put it in the 60s, or we reconceive one of the songs from the 60s as a bossa nova number that encompasses the Academy Award sequence in the end. So the sort of freedom to go, let's not adhere to that. This happened, this happened, this happened. Let's find the songs that match the moments was really helpful. Also, Cher herself interpreted songs and covered songs. So we had kind of in the world of Cher, there was already a versatility about music that we could kind of make to our advantage.
Could I do a little sidebar?
Please.
Jason just alluded to this 6 minute number we have in Act Two, which covers Cher's film career. There was a lot of question from Cher and her pals who were saying, well, is there going to be a scene from Moonstruck? Is there going to be a scene from Silkwood? Is there going to be a scene from Mask? Is there going to be a scene backstage with her and Mike Nichols, or with her and Bogdanovich, or with her and Shanley and Norman Jewison? And I thought, well, you know, if you want to watch the movies, you can watch the movies. Why would you come to a Broadway theater to see a recreation of a movie scene without the people who made that scene famous and without the mise-en-scene of camera and editing? And Jason, who directs films and theater, you know, is very familiar with the idea of, let's call it the film montage concept of you get from here to here on a timeline through the use of music and lap dissolves and, you know, slow motion and that sort of stuff, the odd line of dialogue. But you can't really do that on stage. But in the theater, we can do our version of it. And this sequence is the theater version of that kind of a time span, where in the course of 6 minutes, you see a young woman having decided to be a real honest-to-God actress, sort of luck her way into her first film, and 6 minutes later she's won the Oscar for Best Actress, and it's all done to one of her trademark numbers that Sonny Bono wrote in 1965. It has nothing to do with the film career, and just with a little massaging of lyric here and there, and a few lines of dialogue, and some astonishing appearances of some trademark Bob Mackie costume.
Yeah.
The audience is taken through a decade of a woman's life and career, and in a way that would never work on film or on streaming, but in the theater it's so exhilarating, and it started literally with just an idea. Could this work? And then Jason and Christopher Gattelli, our choreographer, and me and Daryl Waters, a music supervisor, sort of like created a thing on paper and then put it on the cast. And from really, even when it was first done in its first iteration, it was really, really thrilling, because it's the thing that only theater can do.
This number also sort of supports our theme, which is the youngest Cher sort of performs most of this number, even though the oldest Cher is the one that was going through the experience. So the youngest Cher, at a young woman, dreamed of being an actress. So by the end of that sequence, she's the one who holds the Oscar. So we're also trying to look to, like, how do you communicate with all the parts of you that you drag along with you in your life?
You mentioned the costumes by Bob Mackie, which are...
did I?
You did. And there are a lot of them.
There are a lot.
And how many? You did a
count
the
other
day. It's like 635 costumes, 3,000 pieces, 6 million feathers, and a costume change every 35 seconds.
Well, that's my question. How...
And zero underwear.
Which of those costumes proved the most difficult? I mean, there's one sequence that's basically a fashion show in the most delightful way. I mean, the stars come out. They may or may not even sing in that sequence, and then come back. Like, and it's delightful, but I kept thinking to myself, these are complicated. How did they get them on and off, and what was the hardest?
The most complicated part is that Bob, like he said, there isn't a lot underneath them, right? Because
True.
They were very sexy and very form-fitting. So that was one of the toughest things, to figure out how to make those quick changes effective and safe.
Well, you know, I mean, in the theater, what you do is you put a costume on, then you put a costume on over that, and
right.
you put a costume on over that.
Right.
And when you go off, somebody rips the first one off, and you're wearing the second one, then they rip the second one off, and you're wearing the one that's underneath. But when all your body is showing, you can't actually do that. So there has to be this a show that the audience doesn't see, which is the show of dressers
in the dark
with flashlights in their teeth.
Yeah.
And actors who are, you know, just sort of stripped down and to nothing, and then re-clad in almost nothing, and turned around and pushed back into the light, and it's an extraordinary accomplishment that required lots and lots of rehearsal.
I was going to say that you probably have to rehearse even more than whatever was happening on stage in that sequence, right?
It became one of the driving things that we had to solve, both sort of on paper, who's changing when and who,
right.
which is one of the advantages we discovered of having three shares, is one could be changing clothes while the other two were doing that.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But also that the part of what's exciting for the audience about seeing all the clothes, which I think some people sit down to share to hopefully see, is all of them. So
right.
the more, the faster, the better. So we ended up, we got really good at six hands on one woman getting them to change clothes.
Right, right.
And it's not, I mean, it's not just a fashion show. It is another one of these time travel things, because the number begins
right.
and the show is brand new and they have no budget, and the number ends and it's a couple of seasons later and now she really just wants to go home.
Our costumes are astonishing.
Yes. Yeah,
right, right.
But, you know, but the number and all the excitement of the number actually travels us forward in time as well, which is, you know, Jason's right. special genius.
Yeah. And so you've got the script at this point, at some point, and then you realize you have to cast three Chers. What are you looking for? How did you think about the qualities that each would embody?
I mean, of course, we were like, they sort of have to look somewhat like her. They have to maybe be able to sing like her. But for me, it was just like, who has that kind of star swagger? You know, who has? Cher is a planet. She has this gravitational pull, and she's also able to be very authentic at the same time. That's one of the things that I love about her. She's a diva, but you feel like you could just like have a burger with her because you can. And so looking for people that can embody that kind of authenticity.
And how did you think about, Ricky, you were talking about the Cher impersonators. Like, how far is too far when suddenly you turn into, you know, Sean Hayes and Will and Grace pretending to do Cher, right?
We had to turn the dial, and it was different for each actress because there were more Cherisms in the later actor than in when she was sort of finding her own voice, which is part of our story. And so we started small, and we started adding intonation. It was easier to find the Cher voice while singing. We added a few hair flips. We added a little bit of tongue. We had to pull some back because it was too much. Because it was trying to find the balance. How does it feel natural on that person? And also, how does it evoke Cher without feeling like we're trying to be her? Because we found that the more you try and sound like her and be her, the more distancing it is for the audience, because you're like, oh, right, it sounds too much like her.
Have either of you perfected your Cher impression, and can you do it?
Oh, God.
Lord, no.
You know, there just hasn't been enough time.
Yeah.
but you know, maybe we'll work on it now.
We did discover that it made a big difference to put the wigs on the women, and we've just never
worn
them.
Is that because of the hair flip? Or?
It's because of the hair flip. Okay. If that straight hair makes people behave very differently.
Well, and Stephanie is Stephanie.
This is Stephanie J. Block.
Stephanie J. Block.
Starshare, is that what?
Yeah, she plays Starshare, and she came into rehearsal in September and said, "I think I was using white strips on my teeth, and so I had to sort of talk and like put my lip over my teeth in a way that isn't natural for her." And her husband said, "There's the voice. There's the voice." So they present themselves at odd times and odd places, these Cherisms.
Cher herself really understood also, though, the authenticity beneath that. She actually went to Stephanie one day and said, "You're such an incredible performer. You should be as much you as you are me." And that was also one of our driving principles.
And that's certainly true of the three of them. I mean, in a way, it helps their relatability, I think, for the people in the audience, men and women, because they're not, as Jason said, sort of pushed back by an impersonation. We were never interested in impersonations. We were interested in sort of creating the totality of a female person in a way that the audience would understand, that would feel authentic, and that the audience would still feel relatable. Because after all, there's a lot about her life and her career that's not relatable at all. She's just so much more famous than any of us, and has been for so much longer than any of us. So how do you identify with someone who's on that kind of a pedestal? And it was actually through the humanity of the three actresses.
What did you find the most surprising thing you learned, either of you, talking to Cher about her life and what her experiences were, and what do you feel like this show brings forward that people haven't seen before?
One of the things that strikes me about her life, she talks about her life as a survivor and reinvention, which implies all of this sort of forethought. She describes her life like being on a bumper car, which is sort of instinctual. So she didn't plan everything, but what she always planned was being authentic to herself. So all of these moments where she bumped into a wall and then had to reinvent herself, she hadn't manipulated the thinking. She just turned to the next direction like a bumper car and attacked the next thing. So whether that was singing or dance music or acting in movies, the kind of notion that it was her authenticity that allowed her to reinvent herself rather than some sort of external manipulation, that was a big thing that I learned in talking to her. And I thought that was really, that became part of our theme, which is finding yourself is how you find your next step.
I think the thing that I learned that was in the script, because, you know, this is what she told me and this is what I wrote, but I didn't really get it until we had audiences here in New York, that she was in several important senses something of a pioneer. She was a professional woman who was also a mother. She had to be on set, but she also wanted to be with her kid. When she left Sunny, she was broke, and she had to figure out a way to support her mother, her sister, and her child. And then she became successful, and then she lost it all again. And then she went to New York to become an actress with no guarantees of anything, and found herself, again, managing her kids, because she had two by then, and career and family. Finding that balance is something that Cher did long before it became even the point of the feminist movement. I mean, she was really at the vanguard of that, because she became famous at just about the same time that over here on this coast, Betty Friedan was talking about the feminine mystique, and Cher sort of is the feminine mystique in a way. She is the embodiment of all of that, and she was kind of there at the beginning of it as a young, you know, as an adolescent, and now as a mature person who has lived her life, she's constantly bumper carred her way, not just in random ways, but despite the randomness of it, she's always managed to fulfill what in our culture has always been perceived as the traditional male role, which is provider. And at the end of the show, she says, "You know what? Her mother says, I still wish you'd settle down and marry a rich man," which has been sort of a refrain. And she says, "Mother, I am a rich man." And the response that the audience gives,
it's huge.
I mean, it's huge, because it has the ring of truth, because she actually has done that. And I remember Jane Wagner wrote a great line for Lily Tomlin in Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in a sequence about a woman who was trying to have it all. And she said, "Gee, if I had known it was going to be this hard having it all, I would have been willing to settle for less. Cher never settled for less. And here she is at this point demonstrating that. I think that's why that line rings such a loud bell for the audience.
Right. You both alluded to the fact that the show had a run in Chicago. Was it over the summer, right? Before coming here, what was the biggest thing you learned? What was the takeaway from Chicago that influenced what the show is now?
They have really good restaurants.
Well, you go.
I go. That many, many people who sit down have an opinion and a relationship with Cher already, and that ignore that at your peril. I guess that's kind of what we learned, which is we had some really great ideas, but they got in the way of people's access to the things that they loved. So I think we sort of changed the balance, which is to give people some of like full songs and that version of Cher that they know and love. And then once we had that port of entry, then we could explore things they didn't know, you know, behind the scenes, internal thinking, theatrical ideas. And so that was probably the biggest switch, I think, was leaning into people already have a relationship with her. Let's take advantage of that as our way to tell a new story.
There's also, you know, the managing of expectations. People associate Cher with fun.
Yeah.
And Jason's too polite to say it, so I will. I had written a show that was darker, because that was the point I was trying to make. It is possible to find life after love, being, you know, a principal lyric of her most famous recording.
Yeah. And the opening number of this.
And we created a show with a lot of angst in it, and we went, I think, we veered into a darkness that was a disconnect for the audience. And then, having perceived that, what we did, which I think was, you know, rather brave and unusual, is we jettisoned all of that and decided to make a show that did not disconnect with the audience, a show that is based on fun and laughter and a good time around a much simpler idea, that while you think of me, Cher, as this person up here in a G-string prancing around, in fact, it takes a lot of courage for me to do that, because I've always been shy and afraid of people since I was a little girl. And that simple notion of, well, I started out shy and afraid of people, becomes at the end, you know what, I still am. And there are still things that I have to overcome to be able to stand up here in a G-string. But by God, I do it. And you can too. That's why it's called the Cher Show, because it's the Gordon Show or the Juliana Show. Or the Chelsea Show. These are the women who are sitting with us.
Yes,
not just random names, ladies and gentlemen. But you know,
all good names.
It's the, you know, if you want to run your own show, don't worry about not ever being afraid of anything. Understand that you're afraid, and be strong enough to keep that fear and do it anyway. And it's a simple idea, but it's rather articulately stated and beautifully so by Stephanie at the end of the play, and I guess it kind of rings a bell with the audience. Thank goodness, because there are a lot of people out there like that, including me. And I think, yeah, okay, I sort of feel like I can. If she can do it, so can I. And I think that's a great. I think that's a great takeaway for the crowd.
And so I'm talking to the two of you just a couple days before the show opens. This is going to be released a
couple
days after.
We haven't opened yet? I thought we opened.
What's next for you both? Jason, I know you've got another musical coming up.
I start rehearsal, actually right after we open, for a new musical called Superhero, written by Tom Kitt, music and lyrics, and the book by John Logan. And it's a very wonderful, beautiful, emotional, original story.
Cool. And Rick, what's next for you? Do you have anything on screen yet, actually? Do you have screen work coming up?
There'll be a movie next fall, but I'm not sure which one it'll be yet.
Oh, okay.
Oh, which one it'll be.
I know.
Trying to figure which one happen.
They're stacked up like airplanes at JFK.
What's next for you, Rick?
I am going to describe Jason's career for the rest of my life.
Okay.
I was thinking of a podcast. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
More. More is more. It's more.
Sort of a recap, a podcast. So, yeah.
I too, rather insanely, a week after Monday, I guess on the 10th, start rehearsals for a little musical. Oh, it's funny how we both, like, the pendulum has swung away from the gargantuan Cher show to, you know, a small little intimate musical set in London in 1966 at a karaoke club, visited by all the famous music rock and rollers who were waiting to become famous on the brink of the British invasion, and we're going to do it at Paper Mill Playhouse in February.
Right.
So
and what's that called?
It's called My Very Own British Invasion.
Cool.
That way, people know it's about the British invasion. <I'd say.
laughs> Do you enjoy? You seem to have sort of a special. You sort of specialize now in taking this sort of catalog of songs that exists and stringing them together into a story. Do you enjoy that?
What I like is doing things that are different. So while yes, Jersey Boys is a show based on a pre-existing catalog of songs, and so is the Cher show. They're really quite different.
They could not
be
more different, right?
And and thank you for saying that. But I'm also adapting Water for Elephants for the stage as a musical, which has nothing to do with a catalog score with the Pigpen Theatre Collective, and I'm working on a musical for Disney that's based on for the first time they're going to do something that's not a Disney title, and. An original show for I just want to do things that are different. I started really late, Gordon, I don't have that much time left. So I want to just like if something different comes along, I like to see if I can figure out a way to do it.
Good. Well, we can't wait to see what different is coming from you both. Thank you guys. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Gordon.
Happy opening.
Thank you, Gordon.
That was Rick Ellis and Jason Moore, the writer and director of The Cher Show, now on Broadway. If you like what you've heard on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes and subscribe wherever finer podcasts are dispensed. Until next week, see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.